Karen Babine is just out with a new book, Water and What We Know, Following the Roots of a Northern Life. It's a series of essays that explore the meaning of place, identity, and meaning. She's an assistant professor of English at Concordia College in Moorhead, and she grew up in Nevis, Minnesota, which is between Park Rapids and Walker, and she now lives in Fargo. Welcome, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being on. Well, and thanks for writing this book. I have to say, I so enjoyed it. It's just absolutely beautiful. Beautiful book of essays. It almost reads, I don't know, it has a bit of a poetry feel to it. Is that, have you been told that? Was that deliberate?
I think that given the amount of reading that I do and the writing that I've done for so long, I don't see a whole lot of difference in terms of genre. I've studied poetry, I've studied fiction, I've studied nonfiction, and sometimes I like to think that beautiful language isn't genre-specific. So you can have gorgeous poetic language in a novel, and it's just as great as if you found it in a verse.
Mm-hmm. So would you explain a little bit about this group of essays and how you developed the idea for the book?
Well, the idea of the book, it didn't come as one idea. The way that it was conceived came in individual essays, and then I looked at all of them sitting there on my computer hard drive and wondered what the thread was between them and could I make a book out of it. And looking at all of them, water and the relationship of water to land really did see that seemed to be the thread and the spine through all of them, whether it's actual water and where I grew up in northern Minnesota, or if it's lack of water in places like the Great Plains that don't have a lot of surface water. I really saw this relationship and sometimes a great struggle of a relationship in our relationship with water.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, water is so important to us, you know, here where the station is, and a lot of our listeners, of course, on the shore of Lake Superior and the edge of the Boundary mm-hmm. Waters. Who do you feel is going to resonate the most to this book?
I think exactly your listeners, and I think a great deal of Minnesota can find something to connect to in this book, mostly because it's, even though there's a lot of northern Minnesota, north woods, lakes, there's also a great deal that's prairie. My grandpa comes from southwestern Minnesota, and I'm living on the Red River Valley now, and I've spent considerable time in Nebraska on the Great Plains, and so I have just as much affection for prairie as I do for the canopy of trees. And I think that once you start looking at some of the questions that I'm wrestling with in these essays, I think that they are fairly universal questions, and I'm hoping that as people read through these stories and the ideas that I'm working with, that they can find their specific and their universal in the things that I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, to give people an idea of what your book is like, Karen, would you read a passage from, it's from the very beginning of the book for our listeners?
I can do that. This comes from the first essay called Roald Amundsen's Teeth. And to set this up a little bit, when I was a freshman at Concordia, we took a tour of the archives, and one of the things I remember, even back to 1997, was that we got to see Roald Amundsen's teeth, the explorer.
Such a weird artifact.
It's so weird and so wonderful, and he disappeared while exploring, so the only physical remains of him on this planet are in Concordia's archives, which I love that. I love to. It's great. This essay is about this idea of North as being kind of an ideal, and it starts with Itasca, the headwaters of the Mississippi. So this is just from the first part of that essay. Itasca State Park is everything that is right with the world. The root of the name is Vertus Caput, Latin for two head, the name formed of the last three letters of the first word and the first two letters of the second, and this place marks more than the headwaters of the Mississippi River in northern Minnesota. When I'm away from the North Woods, I feel like my lungs can never fully inflate, and when I get back here to Hubbard County, I feel like I can finally breathe. The world here is green, but it isn't so much the variety of colors that make green that make Itasca and northern Minnesota, for that matter, what it is. It's the textures of green, from the lace of ferns to the spikes of pine needles, the poison ivy leaves at your ankles to the birch leaves overhead. Green in Minnesota is more than a color and more than textures. Green becomes the color of light. It becomes the taste in your mouth when you wake up in the morning and step outside your camper. It becomes a sound. You might be able to discern the individual sounds of wind in the leaves and loon calls, but together the sound is simply green. Green is what you wrap yourself in when you go to sleep, regardless of the actual color of your bedding. Green is the warmth of the electric blanket, the cool and the damp of the air coming in through the cracked window above you. Green is what you sprinkle over your morning cereal, what you add to your coffee or tea. And when you leave, green becomes the color of the shadow that follows you home.
I love that. Thank you. It's so beautiful, and I think it gives a really nice taste of your writing. And one thing I wanted to ask you about in there is that you mentioned the origin of the word Itasca.
Yes.
And that's great. I didn't know that. And I like how you have various, I don't know if you'd call it linguistic sort of
things throughout
the book. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about that, about why you did that, put that in?
Well, language to me is incredibly fascinating. And I think that digging back into word roots, whether it's Latin or it's Old Norse or Japanese, that I think language contains more history and nuance than sometimes we get to experience on a daily basis. And there are a couple of moments where digging into a different language illuminates something that I couldn't understand in that way before. And it happens, there's a section of the book where I'm talking about my grandpa's Coast Guard experience on the USS Charlottesville, which after World War II was given to the Russians for a while, and they gave it back, and then it was given to the Japanese, who renamed it the Matsu, which translates to pine tree, but it also translates the verb to wait, which, as in that moment, I was thinking about the white pine trees where I grew up, and it just was the most perfect, illuminating sort of moment. Mm-hmm. And I love that language can do that. And, you know, I'm a writer, I'm an English teacher, and language is incredibly important to me that way.
Yeah, well, it really shows through all those very nice examples and details throughout the book. And you're, even though the subtitle of your book is Following the Roots of a Northern Life, you really... you're really sort of ranging all over the planet in the various water places you're talking about. Why is place so important, Karen? Can you talk about, I guess I was very interested in your idea that place and land connect us through time. What do you mean by that?
I think that landscape and a place, place being not just a location, but a context, that it's all of the information that we get from history, it's geology, it's all of these different things, that there's a knowledge there that human interaction is only a part of it. And I know that we live differently in different places based on what's underneath our feet, because we have to. There's a distinct difference between, I grew up in Hoover County, and that is sugar sand for soil. It erodes really well. But there's no flooding because that sand can't hold cold water. It's perfect soil for potatoes and edible beans and strawberries. But I went to college in Moorhead. I teach here now many years later. And there was an article in the Fargo Forum a couple of days ago that the Red River is only has a 50% chance of flooding this year. And that's a way of life here. And we live our lives here knowing that river flooding is not an if, it's a when. And there's a culture that grows out of what happens when you know what your landscape does. And I think there's a detriment to what if you don't know what a landscape does. My favorite example of this, I like natural disasters, as you can probably tell from the book. They're fascinating to me. But one of my favorites is the 1811-1812 New Madrid earthquakes in Missouri, which is the most active seismic zone outside of California. And that fault has a major quake every 200 years. The geologists have done their scrapings and their work, and they can pretty much guarantee every 200 years there will be a massive quake. The last one was 1812, so we are 3 years overdue for this quake. But, you know, when I was teaching in Nebraska, which is on the outer rings of that fault line, most of my students had no idea that that existed, let alone that there was a geological history there. But when that fault line shakes, when it goes again, it's going to destroy the bridges over the Mississippi River. There are buildings and major metropolitan areas that are not earthquake-proof. It is going to be a major, major disaster. But in 1811, 1812, because it happened December, January, there were a series of five quakes, and they were all over 8 on the Richter scale. It made the Mississippi River run backwards, which is one of those amazing moments that I both cannot imagine, and the imagination is pretty good. Even as I can't fathom what that actually would be like.
No.
But I think there's a problem if you don't know what your place is capable of. So it's a matter of knowing what's individual about where you stand.
Good explanation. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Karen Babine. She's out with a new book, Water and What We Know, Following the Roots of a Northern Life. And she's speaking with us from Fargo right now. So speaking of natural disasters, I want to veer off and ask you to tell the story, if you would, in your own words about, am I saying this right, Tambora?
Oh, yeah.
I had no idea. Mm-hmm. This was a total revelation to me.
I love that volcano.
Very interesting.
I love that volcano.
Could you briefly explain this? Because this really blew me away.
Okay, so in 1815, there's a volcano in Indonesia, Mount Tambora, blew. One of the largest volcanic eruptions in all of recorded history. And it threw up so much ash that it changed the climate of the planet. And so 1816 was, they called it the year without summer because it was so cold across the globe that nothing would grow. There are reports out of New England, Ohio, about how thick the ice was on glass windows in, say, June. Like, nothing grew. And the effect of that volcano on so many different things is just marvelous. It was the first mass migration out of New England because no crops would grow. And so without that volcano, we probably wouldn't have gotten past the Appalachian Mountains. My favorite part of that volcano is that if not for that volcano, we would not have gotten Frankenstein.
I like that story. They were forced to stay indoors.
They're forced to stay indoors. So Percy Bysshe Shelley and Lord Byron and Mary Shelley, they're in Geneva. It's way too cold to go outside and do anything. So they have a contest to see who can write the best ghost story. And the guys give up, mostly because I think they're poets and that just isn't the way that their brains work. And so Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein. And you can see, if you read that book, there are shades of the volcano and the uncertainty of landscape and environment in there. And I think when you look at other pieces of literature, I mean, I teach literature, that looking to see how a landscape and the environment, whether it's built or natural, plays a role in the way that the characters function, I think you have to do that. And that's one of my favorite things to look for when I read anything.
Mm-hmm. I was so fascinated by that. I did not know about that volcano and how it was so influential on the planet's weather. Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of surprised. I mean, I think I have a normal education. I'd never heard of it. I mean, are people being taught about it, or apparently
not? I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so. But the thing about those volcanoes is that it's not the last volcano to change the climate. The last massive major one was Pinatubo, 1991, I think. And that was in the Philippines. And that threw up enough ash to change the climate and bring down the global temperature for a couple of years. So it does happen. It continues to happen. And, you know, I'm teaching this class with natural disasters right now. And if I don't walk into the class and be, if I'm not excited about some sort of something happening somewhere, oh, there's an earthquake or there was a volcano. Did you hear about this? If I don't weird out my students when I walk into class, I don't feel like I'm doing my job.
I bet you're doing it really well. Well, I have one more question before we have to let you go, which is as much as, I mean, there's so many interesting stories in your book and it's beautifully written and you quote a bunch of other books just that seem perfect and cite songs and, but the book also really poses as many questions as it answers for me. Mm-hmm. And why set it up that way?
The best thing about nonfiction and essays for me is that they are very driven by curiosity, and I don't have all the answers. All I have are questions that drive my life, drive my what I do and how I look at the world. And my best work as a writer and why I write is I am in pursuit of those questions, and the best I can do is answer for myself at one point in time, and maybe a couple of years down the road I might answer it differently, but I also want other people to look at those questions and answer them for themselves, because the differences that we have in our experiences and how we live in different places, there's a kaleidoscope of really interesting things that I'd like, a conversation that I'd like to be a part of.
Yes. Well, thank you. Karen, do you have a website that people could go to learn more about you and your work?
I do. It's KarenBabine.com.
And how do you spell that?
KarenBabine.com.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Again, it was just a really beautiful book, Water and What We Know, Following the Roots of a Northern Life. And it's just out from the University of Minnesota Press. I'm assuming you can get it at bookstores everywhere or order it through bookstores everywhere. And
you can.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Karen.
Thanks, Anne. I enjoyed this.
Me too. All the best.